Chapter 10 The Conquered City 1 Up till now, whatever his days had been like, Mark had usually slept well. This night sleep failed him. He had not written to Jane. He had spent the day keeping out of sight and doing nothing in particular. The wakeful night moved all his fears onto a new level. He was, of course, a materialist in theory, and, also in theory, he was past the age at which one can have night fears. But now, as the wind rattled his window hour after hour, he felt those old terrors again, the old exquisite thrill as of cold fingers delicately travelling down his back. Materialism is, in fact, no protection. Those who seek it in that hope, they are not a negligible class, will be disappointed. The thing you fear is impossible. Well and good. Can you therefore cease to fear it? Not here and now. And what then? If you must see ghosts, it is better not to disbelieve in them. He was called earlier than usual, and with his tea came a note. The deputy director sent his compliments and must ask Mr. Studdock to call on him instantly about a most urgent and distressing matter. Mark dressed and obeyed. In Wither's room he found Wither and Miss Hardcastle. To Mark's surprise, and momentarily to his relief, Wither showed no recollection of their last meeting. Indeed, his manner was genial, even deferential, though extremely grave.
Good morning, Mr. Studdock," he said. "It is with the greatest regret that I would not have kept you from your breakfast unless I had felt it in your own interest you should be placed in full possession of the facts at the earliest possible moment. You will, of course, regard all that I am about to say as strictly confidential. The matter is a distressing, or at least an embarrassing, one. I feel sure that as the conversation proceeds, oh, pray be seated, Mr. Studdock. You will realize in your present situation how very wise we have been in securing from the outset a police force, to give it that rather unfortunate name, of our own."
Mark licked his lips and sat down.
"My reluctance to raise the question," continued Wither, "would, however, be very much more serious if I did not feel able to assure you, in advance, you understand, of the complete confidence which we all feel in you, and which I very much hoped." Here, for the first time, he looked Mark in the eyes. "You were beginning to reciprocate. We regard ourselves here as being so many brothers and sisters, so that whatever passes between us in this room can be regarded as confidential in the fullest possible sense of the word. And, I take it, we shall all feel entitled to discuss the subject I am about to mention in the most human and informal manner possible."
Miss Hardcastle's voice, suddenly breaking in, had an effect not wholly unlike that of a pistol shot. "You have lost your wallet, Studdock?" she said.
"My wallet?" said Mark.
"Yes, wallet, pocket-book, thing you keep notes and letters in."
"Yes, I have. Have you found it?"
"Does it contain £3.10, counterfoil of postal order for 5 shillings, letters from a woman signing herself Myrtle, from the bursar of Bracton, from G. Hernshaw, F. A. Brown, M. Belcher, and a bill for a dress suit from Simons and Son, 32A Market Street, Edgestow?"
"Well, more or less so."
"There it is," said Miss Hardcastle, pointing to the table. "Oh, no, you don't," she added, as Mark made a step towards it. "What on earth is all this about?" said Mark. His tone was that which I think almost any man would have used in the circumstances, but which policemen are apt to describe as blustering. "None of that," said Miss Hardcastle. "This wallet was found in the grass beside the road about 5 yards away from Hengist's body."
"My God," said Studdock, "you don't mean—"
"Oh, the thing's absurd." "There's no use appealing to me," said Miss Hardcastle. "I'm not a solicitor, nor a jury, nor a judge. I'm only a policewoman. I'm telling you the facts."
"Do I understand that I'm suspected of murdering Hengist?" "I don't really think," said the deputy director, "that you need have the slightest apprehension that there is, at this stage, any radical difference between your colleagues and yourself as to the light in which this very painful matter should be regarded. The question is really a constitutional one."
"Constitutional?" said Mark angrily. "If I understand her, Miss Hardcastle is accusing me of murder." Wither's eyes looked at him as if from an infinite distance.
"Oh," said he, "I don't really think that does justice to Miss Hardcastle's position. That element in the Institute which she represents would be strictly ultra vires in doing anything of the kind within the NICE. supposing, but purely, of course, for purposes of argument, that they wished or should wish at a later stage to do so. While in relation to the outside authorities, their function, however we define it, would be quite inconsistent with any action of the sort, at least in the sense in which I understand you to be using the words. "But it's the outside authorities with whom I'm concerned, I suppose," said Mark. His mouth had become dry, and he had difficulty in making himself audible. "As far as I can understand, Miss Hardcastle means I'm going to be arrested." "On the contrary," said Wither, "this is precisely one of those cases in which you see the enormous value of possessing our own executive. Here is a matter which might, I fear, cause you very considerable inconvenience if the ordinary police had discovered the wallet, or if we were in the position of an ordinary citizen who felt it his duty, as we should ourselves feel it our duty, if we ever came to be in that very different situation, to hand over the wallet to them. I do not know if Miss Hardcastle has made it perfectly clear to you that it was her officers, and they only, who have made this, embarrassing discovery." "What on earth do you mean?" said Mark. "If Miss Hardcastle does not think there's a prima facie case against me, why am I being arraigned in this way at all? And if she does, how can she avoid informing the authorities?"
"My dear friend," said Wither, in an antediluvian tone, "there is not the slightest desire on the part of the committee to insist on defining, in cases of this sort, the powers of action of our own police, much less, what is here in question, their powers of inaction. I do not think anyone had suggested that Miss Hardcastle should be obliged, in any sense that limited her own initiative, to communicate to outside authorities, who by their very organization must be supposed to be less adapted for dealing with such imponderable and quasi-technical inquiries as will often arise, any facts acquired by her and her staff in the course of their internal functioning within the NICE. "Do I understand," said Mark, "that Miss Hardcastle thinks she has facts justifying my arrest for the murder of Mr. Hengist, but is kindly offering to suppress them?"
"You got it now, Studdock," said the fairy. A moment later, for the first time in Mark's experience, she actually lit her cheroot, blew a cloud of smoke, and smiled, or at least drew back her lips so that the teeth became visible. "But that's not what I want," said Mark. This was not quite true. The idea of having the thing hushed up in any way and almost on any terms when it first presented itself a few seconds ago had come like air to one suffocating. But something like citizenship was still alive in him, and he proceeded, almost without noticing this emotion, to follow a different line. "I don't want that," he said, speaking rather too loud. "I'm an innocent man. I think I'd better go to the police, the real police, I mean, at once."
"If you want to be tried for your life," said the fairy, "that's another matter."
"I want to be vindicated," said Mark. "The charge would fall to pieces at once. There was no conceivable motive, and I have an alibi. Everyone knows I slept here that night."
"Really?" said the fairy.
"What do you mean?" said Mark.
"There's always a motive, you know," said she, "for anyone murdering anyone. The police are only human. When the machinery is started, they naturally want a conviction."
Mark assured himself he was not frightened. If only Wither didn't keep all his windows shut and then have a roaring fire.
"There's a letter you wrote," said the fairy.
"What letter?"
"A letter to a Mr. Pelham of your own college, dated 6 weeks ago, in which you say, 'I wish Bill the Blizzard could be moved to a better world.'"
Like a sharp physical pain, the memory of that scribbled note came back to Mark. It was the sort of silly jocularity one used in the progressive element, the kind of thing that might be said a dozen times a day in Bracton about an opponent, or even about a bore.
"How does that letter come to be in your hands?" said Mark.
"I think, Mr. Studdock," said the deputy director, "it would be very improper to suggest that Miss Hardcastle should give any kind of exposition, in detail, I mean, of the actual working of the institutional police. In saying this, I do not mean for one moment to deny that the fullest possible confidence between all the members of the NICE is one of the most valuable characteristics it can have, and, indeed, a sine qua non of that really concrete and organic life which we expect it to develop. But there are necessarily certain spheres, not sharply defined, of course, but inevitably revealing themselves in response to the environment and obedience to the indwelling ethos or dialectic of the whole, in which a confidence that involved the verbal interchange of facts would defeat its own end."
You don't suppose, said Mark, that anyone could take that letter to be meant seriously?
Ever tried to make a policeman understand anything? Said the fairy.
I mean what you call a real policeman.
Mark said nothing.
And I don't think the alibi is specially good, said the fairy. You were seen talking to Bill at dinner. You were seen going out of the front door with him when he left. You were not seen coming back. Nothing is known of your movements till breakfast time next morning. If you had gone with him by car to the scene of the murder, you would have had ample time to walk back and go to bed by about 2:15. Frosty night, you know. No reason why your shoes should have been specially muddy or anything of that sort.
If I might pick up a point made by Miss Hardcastle, said Wither, this is a very good illustration of the immense importance of the institutional police. There are so many fine shades involved which it would be unreasonable to expect the ordinary authorities to understand, but which, so long as they remain, so to speak, in our own family circle, I look upon the NICE, Mr. Studdock, as one great family, need develop no tendency to lead to any miscarriage of justice. Owing to some mental confusion which had before now assailed him in dentists' operating rooms and in the studies of headmasters, Mark began almost to identify the situation which seemed to be imprisoning him with his literal imprisonment by the four walls of that hot room. If only he could once get out of it, on any terms, out into the free air and sunlight, away over the countryside, away from the recurrent creak of the deputy director's collar and the red stains on the end of Miss Hardcastle's cheroot and the picture of the king which hung above the fireplace.
"You really advise me, sir," he said, "not to go to the police?"
"To the police?" said Wither, as if this idea were completely new. "I don't think, Mr. Studdock, that anyone had quite contemplated your taking any irrevocable action of that sort. It might even be argued that by such an action you would be guilty, unintentionally guilty, I hasten to add, of some degree of disloyalty to your colleagues, and specially to Miss Hardcastle. You would, of course, be placing yourself outside our protection."
"That's the point, Studdock," said the fairy. "Once you are in the hands of the police, you are in the hands of the police."
The moment of Mark's decision had passed by him without his noticing it.
"Well," he said, "what do you propose to do?"
"Me," said the fairy.
"Sit tight. It's lucky for you that it was we and not some outsider who found the wallet."
"Not only fortunate for Mr. Studdock," added Wither gently, "but for the whole NICE. We could not have been indifferent."
"There's only one snag," said the fairy, "and that is that we haven't got your letter to Pelham, only a copy. But with any luck, nothing will come of that."
"Then there's nothing to be done at present," said Mark.
"No," said Wither, "no, no immediate action of any official character. It is, of course, very advisable that you should act, as I am sure you will, with the greatest prudence and caution for the next few months. As long as you are with us, Scotland Yard would, I feel, see the inconvenience of trying to act unless they had a very clear case indeed. It is no doubt probable that some trial of strength between the ordinary executive and our own organization will take place within the next 6 months. But I think it very unlikely that they would choose to make this a test case."
Wither's attitude was paternal.
"But do you mean they suspect me already?" said Mark.
"We'll hope not," said the fairy. "Of course they want a prisoner, that's only natural. But they'd a damn sight rather have one who doesn't involve them in searching the premises of the NICE.
"But look here, damn it," said Mark. "Aren't you hoping to catch the thief in a day or two? Aren't you going to do anything?"
"The thief?" said Wither. "There has been no suggestion so far that the body was rifled."
"I mean the thief who stole my wallet."
"Oh, your wallet," said the other very gently, stroking his refined, handsome face. "I see. I understand, do I, that you are advancing a charge of theft against some person or persons unknown."
"But good God," shouted Mark, "were you not assuming that someone stole it? Do you think I was there myself? Do you both think I am a murderer?"
"Please," said the deputy director, "please, Mr. Studdock, you really must not shout. Quite apart from the indiscretion of it, I must remind you that you are in the presence of a lady. As far as I can remember, nothing has been said on our side about murder, and no charge of any sort has been made. My only anxiety is to make perfectly clear what we are all doing. There are, of course, certain lines of conduct and a certain mode of procedure which it would be theoretically possible for you to adopt, and which would make it very difficult for us to continue the discussion. I am sure Miss Hardcastle agrees with me." "It's all one to me," said the fairy. "Why Studdock should start bellowing at us because we are trying to keep him out of the dock, I don't know. But that's for him to decide. I've got a busy day and don't want to hang about here all morning."
"Really," said Mark, "I should have thought it was excusable to—"
"Pray compose yourself, Mr. Studdock," said Wither.
"As I said before, we look upon ourselves as one family, and nothing like a formal apology is required. We all understand one another, and all dislike scenes. I might perhaps be allowed to mention, in the friendliest possible manner, that any instability of temperament would be viewed by the committee as, well, as not very favourable to the confirmation of your appointment. We are all speaking, of course, in the strictest confidence."
Mark was far past bothering about the job for its own sake, but he realized that the threat of dismissal was now a threat of hanging.
"I'm sorry if I was rude," he said at last. "What do you advise me to do?"
"Don't put your nose outside Bellbury, Studdock," said the fairy.
"I do not think Miss Hardcastle could have given you better advice," said Wither. "And now that Mrs. Studdock is going to join you here, this temporary captivity, I am using that word you will understand in a metaphorical sense, will not be a serious hardship. You must look upon this as your home, Mr. Studdock."
Oh, that reminds me, sir," said Mark. "I'm not really quite sure about having my wife here. As a matter of fact, she's not in very good health."
"But surely, in that case, you must be all the more anxious to have her here."
"I don't believe it would suit her, sir." The D.D.'s eyes wandered, and his voice became lower.
"I had almost forgotten, Mr. Studdock, to congratulate you on your introduction to our head. It marks an important transition in your career. We all now feel that you are really one of us in a deeper sense. I am sure that nothing is further from your intention than to repel the friendly, the almost fatherly concern he feels about you. He is very anxious to welcome Mrs. Studdock among us at the earliest opportunity."
"Why?" said Mark suddenly. Wither looked at Mark with an indescribable smile.
"My dear boy," he said, "unity, you know. The family circle. She'd be company for Miss Hardcastle."
Before Mark had recovered from this staggeringly new conception, Wither rose and shuffled towards the door. He paused with one hand on the handle and laid the other on Mark's shoulder.
"You must be hungry for your breakfast," he said. "Don't let me delay you. Behave with the greatest caution, and—"
Here his face suddenly changed. The widely opened mouth looked all at once like the mouth of some enraged animal. What had been the senile vagueness of the eyes became an absence of all specifically human expression.
"And bring the girl. Do you understand? Get your wife," he added. "The head. He's not patient."
2. As Mark closed the door behind him, he immediately thought, "Now, they're both in there together, safe for a minute at least." Without even waiting to get his hat, he walked briskly to the front door and down the drive. Nothing but physical impossibility would stop him from going to Edgestow and warning Jane. After that, he had no plans. Even the vague idea of escaping to America, which, in a simpler age, comforted so many a fugitive, was denied him. He had already read in the papers the warm approval of the NICE and all its works, which came from the United States and from Russia. Some poor tool just like himself had written them. Its claws were embedded in every country. On the liner, if he should ever succeed in sailing, on the tender, if he should ever make some foreign port, its ministers would be waiting for him. Now he was past the road. He was in the belt of trees. Scarcely a minute had passed since he had left the D.D.'s office, and no one had overtaken him. But yesterday's adventure was happening over again. A tall, stooped, shuffling, creaking figure, humming a tune, barred his way. Mark had never fought. Ancestral impulses lodged in his body, that body which was in so many ways wiser than his mind, directed the blow which he aimed at the head of his senile obstructor. But there was no impact. The shape had suddenly vanished. Those who know best were never fully agreed as to the explanation of this episode. It may have been that Mark, both then and on the previous day, being overwrought, saw a hallucination of Wither where Wither was not. It may be that the continual appearance of Wither, which at almost all hours haunted so many rooms and corridors of Bellbury, was, in one well-verified sense of the word, a ghost,
one of those sensory impressions which a strong personality in its last decay can imprint most commonly after death, but sometimes before it, on the very structure of a building, and which are removed not by exorcism, but by architectural alterations. Or it may, after all, be that souls who have lost the intellectual good do indeed receive in turn, and for a short period, the vain privilege of thus reproducing themselves in many places as wraiths. At any rate, the thing, whatever it was, vanished. The path ran diagonally across a field in grass, now powdered with frost, and the sky was hazy blue. Then came a stile. After that the path ran for 3 fields along the edge of a spinney. Then, a little to the left, past the back parts of a farm, then along a ride through a wood. After that, the spire of Courthampton was in sight. Mark's feet had now got warm, and he was beginning to feel hungry. Then he went across a road, through a herd of cattle that put down their heads and snorted at him, across a stream by a footbridge, and so into the frozen ruts of the lane that led him into Courthampton. The first thing he saw as he came into the village street was a farm cart. A woman and 3 children sat beside the man who was driving it, and in the cart were piled chests of drawers, bedsteads, mattresses, boxes, and a canary in a cage. Immediately after it came a man and woman and child on foot, wheeling a perambulator. It also was piled with small household property. After that came a family pushing a handcart, and then a heavily loaded trap, and then an old car, blowing its horn incessantly, but unable to get out of its place in the procession. A steady stream of such traffic was passing through the village. Mark had never seen war. If he had, he would have recognized at once the signs of flight. In all those plodding horses and men, and in all those loaded vehicles, he would have read clearly the message, "Enemy behind." The traffic was so continuous that it took him a long time to get to the crossroads by the pub, where he could find a glazed and framed table of buses. There would not be one to Edgestow till 12:15. He hung about, understanding nothing of what he saw, but wondering. Courthampton was normally a very quiet village. By a happy and not uncommon illusion, he felt less endangered now that Belbury was out of sight, and thought surprisingly little about his future. He thought sometimes about Jane, and sometimes about bacon and eggs, and fried fish, and dark, fragrant streams of coffee pouring into large cups. At 11:30 the pub opened. He went in and ordered a pint and some bread and cheese. The bar was at first empty. During the next half hour, men dropped in one by one, till about 4 were present. They did not at first talk about the unhappy procession which continued all this time to pass the windows. For some time, indeed, they did not talk at all. Then a very little man with a face like an old potato observed to no one in particular, "I seen old Rumbold the other night." No one replied for 5 minutes, and then a very young man in leggings said, "I reckon he's sorry he ever tried it." In this way the conversation about Rumbold trickled on for some time. It was only when the subject of Rumbold was thoroughly exhausted that the talk, very indirectly and by gradual stages, began to throw some light on the stream of refugees. "Still coming out," said one man. "Ah," said another. "Can't be many left there by now. Don't know where they'll all get in, I'm sure." Little by little the whole thing came out. These were the refugees from Edgestow. Some had been turned out of their houses, some scared by the riots, and still more by the restoration of order. Something like a terror appeared to have been established in the town. "They tell me there were 200 arrests yesterday," said the landlord. "Ah," said the young man, "they're hard cases, those NICE police, every one of them. They put the wind up my old dad proper, I tell 'ee," he ended with a laugh. "'Tain't the police so much as the workmen, by what I hear," said another. "They never ought to have brought those Welsh and Irish." But that was about as far as the criticism went. What struck Mark deeply was the almost complete absence of indignation among the speakers, or even of any distinct sympathy with the refugees. Everyone present knew of at least one outrage in Edgestow, but all agreed that these refugees must be greatly exaggerating. "It says in this morning's paper that things are pretty well settling down," said the landlord. "That's right," agreed the others. "There'll always be some who get awkward," said the potato-faced man. "What's the good of getting awkward?" said another. "It's got to go on. You can't stop it." "That's what I say," said the landlord. Fragments of articles which Mark himself had written drifted to and fro.
Apparently he and his kind had done their work well. Miss Hardcastle had rated too high the resistance of the working classes to propaganda. When the time came, he had no difficulty in getting onto the bus. It was indeed empty, for all the traffic was going in the opposite direction. It put him down at the top of Market Street, and he set out at once to walk up to the flat. The whole town wore a new expression. One house out of three was empty. About half the shops had their windows boarded up. As he gained height and came into the region of large villas with gardens, he noticed that many of these had been requisitioned and bore white placards with the NICE symbol, a muscular male nude grasping a thunderbolt. At every corner, and often in between, lounged or sauntered the NICE police, helmeted, swinging their clubs, with revolvers in holsters on their black, shiny belts. Their round, white faces, with open mouths slowly revolving as they chewed gum, remained long in his memory. There were also notices everywhere, which he did not stop to read. They were headed Emergency Regulations, and bore the signature Featherstone. Would Jane be in? He felt he could not bear it if Jane should not be in. He was fingering his latchkey in his pocket long before he reached the house. The front door was locked. This meant that the Hutchinsons, who occupied the ground floor, were away. He opened it and went in. It seemed cold and damp on the staircase, cold and damp and dark on the landing. "Jane!" he shouted as he unlocked the door of the flat. But he had already lost hope. As soon as he was inside the door, he knew the place was uninhabited. A pile of unopened letters lay on the inside doormat. There was no sound, not a tick of a clock. Everything was in order. Jane must have left some morning immediately after doing all the rooms. The tea-cloths hanging in the kitchen were bone dry. They clearly had not been used for at least 24 hours. The bread in the cupboard was stale. There was a jug half full of milk, but the milk had thickened and would not pour. He continued stumping from room to room long after he was quite certain of the truth, staring at the staleness and pathos which pervades deserted homes. But obviously it was no good hanging about here. A splutter of unreasonable anger arose. Why the hell hadn't Jane told him she was going away? Or had someone taken her away? Perhaps there was a note for him. He took a pile of letters off the mantelpiece, but they were only letters he had put there himself to be answered. Then on the table he noticed an envelope addressed to Mrs. Dimble at her own house over beyond the Wynd. So that damned woman had been here. Those Dimbles had always, he felt, disliked him. They'd probably asked Jane to stay with them. Been interfering somehow, no doubt. He must go down to Northumberland and see Dimble. The idea of being annoyed with the Dimbles occurred to Mark almost as an inspiration. To bluster a little as an injured husband in search of his wife would be a pleasant change for the attitudes he had recently been compelled to adopt. On the way downtown he stopped to have a drink. As he came to the Bristol and saw the NICE placard on it, he had almost said, "Oh, damn," and turned away, before he suddenly remembered that he was himself a high official in the NICE, and by no means a member of that general public whom the Bristol now excluded. They asked him who he was at the door, and became obsequious when he told them. There was a pleasant fire burning. After the gruelling day he had had, he felt justified in ordering a large whisky, and after it he had a second. It completed the change in his mental weather which had begun at the moment when he first conceived the idea of having a grievance against the Dimbles. The whole state of Edgestow had something to do with it. There was an element in him to which all these exhibitions of power suggested chiefly how much nicer and how much more appropriate it was, all said and done, to be part of the NICE than to be an outsider. Even now, had he been taking all this démarche about a murder trial too seriously? Of course, that was the way Wither managed things. He liked to have something hanging over everyone. It was only a way to keep him at Belbury and to make him send for Jane. And when one came to think of it, why not? She couldn't go on indefinitely living alone. And the wife of a man who meant to have a career and live at the centre of things would have to learn to be a woman of the world. Anyway, the first thing was to see that fellow Dimble. He left the Bristol feeling, as he would have said, a different man. Indeed, he was a different man. From now onwards, till the moment of final decision should meet him, the different men in him appeared with startling rapidity, and each seemed very complete while it lasted. Thus, skidding violently from one side to the other, his youth approached the moment at which he would begin to be a person. 3.
"Come in,"
said Dimble in his rooms at Northumberland. He had just finished with his last pupil for the day, and was intending to start for St. Anne's in a few minutes.
"Oh, it's you, Studdock," he added as the door opened. "Come in."
He tried to speak naturally, but he was surprised at the visit and shocked by what he saw. Studdock's face appeared to him to have changed since they last met. It had grown fatter and paler, and there was a new vulgarity in the expression.
"I've come to ask about Jane," said Mark. "Do you know where she is?"
"I can't give you her address, I'm afraid," said Dimble.
"Do you mean you don't know it?"
"I can't give it," said Dimble.
According to Mark's programme, this was the point at which he should have begun to take a strong line. But he did not feel the same now that he was in the room. Dimble had always treated him with scrupulous politeness, and Mark had always felt that Dimble disliked him. This had not made him dislike Dimble. It had only made him uneasily talkative in Dimble's presence and anxious to please. Vindictiveness was by no means one of Mark's vices, for Mark liked to be liked. A snub sent him away dreaming of not revenge, but of brilliant jokes or achievements which would one day conquer the goodwill of the man who had snubbed him. If he were ever cruel, it would be downwards to inferiors and outsiders who solicited his regard, not upwards to those who rejected it. There was a good deal of the spaniel in him.
"What do you mean?" he asked. "I don't understand."
"If you have any regard for your wife's safety, you will not ask me to tell you where she has gone," said Dimble.
"Safety?"
"Safety," repeated Dimble with great sternness.
"Safety from what?"
"Well, don't you know what has happened?"
"What's happened?"
"On the night of the big riot, the institutional police attempted to arrest her. She escaped, but not before they had tortured her."
"Tortured her? What do you mean?"
"Burned her with cigars."
"Well, that's what I've come about," said Mark. "Jane, I'm afraid she is on the verge of a nervous breakdown. That didn't really happen, you know."
"The doctor who dressed the burns thinks otherwise."
"Oh, great Scott," said Mark. "So they really did. But look here." Under the quiet stare of Dimble, he found it difficult to speak.
"Well, why have I not been told of this outrage?" he shouted. "By your colleagues?" asked Dimble dryly. "It is an odd question to ask me. You ought to understand the workings of the NICE better than I do."
"Well, why didn't you tell me? Why has nothing been done about it? Have you been to the police?"
"The institutional police?"
"No, the ordinary police."
"Do you really not know that there are no ordinary police left in Edgestow?"
"Well, I suppose there are some magistrates."
"There is the emergency commissioner, Lord Featherstone."
"You seem to misunderstand. This is a conquered and occupied city."
"Then why, in heaven's name, didn't you get on to me?"
"You?" said Dimble.
For one moment, the first for many years, Mark saw himself exactly as a man like Dimble saw him. It almost took his breath away.
"Look here," he said, "you don't—"
"Oh, it's too fantastic."
"Well, you don't imagine I knew about it? You don't really believe I sent policemen about to manhandle my own wife?"
He had begun on the note of indignation, but ended by trying to insinuate a little jocularity. If only Dimble would give even the ghost of a smile anything to move the conversation onto a different level. But Dimble said nothing, and his face did not relax. He had not, in fact, been perfectly sure that Mark might not have sunk even to this, but out of charity he did not wish to say so.
"I know you've always disliked me," said Mark, "but I didn't know it was quite as bad as that."
And again Dimble was silent, but for a reason Mark could not guess. The truth was that his shaft had gone home. Dimble's conscience had for years accused him of a lack of charity towards Studdock, and he had struggled to amend it. He was struggling now.
"Well," said Studdock in a dry voice, after the silence had lasted for several seconds, "there doesn't seem to be much more to say. I insist on being told where Jane is."
"Do you want her to be taken to Belbury?"
Mark winced.
It was as if the other had read the very thought he had had in the Bristol half an hour ago. "I don't see, Dimble," he said, "why I should be cross-questioned in this way. Where is my wife?" "I have no permission to tell you. She is not in my house, nor under my protection. She is well and happy and safe. If you still have the slightest regard for her happiness, you will make no attempt to get in touch with her."
"Am I a sort of leper or criminal that I can't even be trusted to know her address?"
"Excuse me.
You are a member of the NICE, who have already insulted, tortured, and arrested her. Since her escape, she has been left alone only because your colleagues do not know where she is. And if it really was the NICE police, do you suppose I'm not going to have a very full explanation out of them? Damn it, what do you take me for? I can only hope that you have no power in the NICE at all. If you have no power, then you cannot protect her. If you have, then you are identified with its policy. In neither case will I help you to discover where Jane is. Oh, this is fantastic, said Mark. Even if I do happen to hold a job in the NICE for the moment, you know me. I do not know you, said Dimble. I have no conception of your aims or motives. He seemed to Mark to be looking at him, not with anger or contempt, but with that degree of loathing which produces in those who feel it a kind of embarrassment, as if he were an obscenity which decent people are forced, for very shame, to pretend that they have not noticed. In this Mark was quite mistaken. In reality, his presence was acting on Dimble as a summons to rigid self-control. Dimble was simply trying very hard not to hate, not to despise, above all not to enjoy hating and despising, and he had no idea of the fixed severity which this effort gave to his face. The whole of the rest of the conversation went on under this misunderstanding. "There has been some ridiculous mistake," said Mark. "I tell you, I'll look into it thoroughly. I'll make a row. I suppose some newly enrolled policeman got drunk or something. Well, he'll be broken. It was the chief of your police, Miss Hardcastle herself, who did it." "Very well, I'll break her, then. Did you suppose I was going to take it lying down? But there must be some mistake. It can't—" "Do you know Miss Hardcastle well?" asked Dimble. Mark was silenced, and he thought, quite wrongly, that Dimble was reading his mind to the bottom, and seeing there his certainty that Miss Hardcastle had done this very thing, and that he had no more power of calling her to account than of stopping the revolution of the earth. Suddenly the immobility of Dimble's face changed, and he spoke in a new voice. "Have you the means to bring her to book?" he said. "Are you already as near the centre of Belbury as that? If so, then you have consented to the murder of Hengist, the murder of Compton. If so, it was by your orders that Mary Prescott was raped and battered to death in the sheds behind the station. It is with your approval that criminals, honest criminals whose hands you are unfit to touch, are being taken from the jails to which British judges sent them on the conviction of British juries and packed off to Belbury to undergo for an indefinite period, out of reach of the law, whatever tortures and assaults on personal identity you call remedial treatment. It is you who have driven 2,000 families from their homes to die of exposure in every ditch from here to Birmingham or Worcester. It is you who can tell us why Place and Rowley and Cunningham, at 80 years of age, have been arrested, and where they are. And if you are as deeply in it as that, not only will I not deliver Jane into your hands, but I would not deliver my dog." "Oh, really, really," said Mark, "this is absurd. I know one or two high-handed things have been done. You always get some of the wrong sort in a police force, especially at first. But, I mean to say, what have I ever done that you should make me responsible for every action that any NICE official has taken, or is said to have taken, in the gutter press?" "Gutter press!" thundered Dimble, who seemed to Mark to be even physically larger than he was a few minutes before. "What nonsense is this? Do you suppose I don't know that you have control of every paper in the country except one, and that one has not appeared this morning? Its printers have gone on strike. The poor dupes say they will not print articles attacking the People's Institute. Where the lies in all the other papers come from, you know better than I." It may seem strange to say that Mark, having long lived in a world without charity, had nevertheless very seldom met real anger. Malice in plenty he had encountered, but it all operated by snubs and sneers and stabbing in the back. The forehead and eyes and voice of this elderly man had an effect on him which was stifling and unnerving. At Belbury, one used the words whining and yapping to describe any opposition which the actions of Belbury aroused in the outer world, and Mark had never had enough imagination to realize what the whining would really be like if you met it face to face. "I tell you, I knew nothing about it," he shouted. "Damn it, I'm the injured party. The way you talk, anyone would think it was your wife who'd been ill-treated." "So it might have been. So it may be. It may be any man or woman in England. It was a woman and a citizen. What does it matter whose wife it was? But I tell you, I'll raise hell about it. I'll break the infernal bitch who did it, if it means breaking the whole NICE.
Dimble said nothing. Mark knew that Dimble knew that he was talking nonsense. Yet Mark could not stop. If he did not bluster, he would not know what to say. "Sooner than put up with this," he shouted, "I'll leave the NICE."
"Do you mean that?" asked Dimble with a sharp glance.
And to Mark, whose ideas were now all one fluid confusion of wounded vanity and jostling fears and shames, this glance once more appeared accusing and intolerable. In reality, it had been a glance of awakened hope, for charity hopes all things. But there was caution in it, and between hope and caution, Dimble found himself once more reduced to silence.
"I see you don't trust me," said Mark, instinctively summoning to his face the manly and injured expression which had often served him well in headmaster's studies.
Dimble was a truthful man.
"No," he said after a longish pause, "I don't quite."
Mark shrugged his shoulders and turned away.
"Studdock," said Dimble, "this is not a time for foolery or compliments. It may be that both of us are within a few minutes of death. You have probably been shadowed into the college, and I, at any rate, don't propose to die with polite insincerities in my mouth. I don't trust you. Why should I? You are, at least in some degree, the accomplice of the worst men in the world. Your very coming to me this afternoon may be only a trap."
"Don't you know me better than that?" said Mark.
"Oh, stop talking nonsense," said Dimble. "Stop posturing and acting, if only for a minute. Who are you to talk like that? They have corrupted better men than you or me before now. Strake was a good man once. Philostrato was at least a great genius. Even Alcassan, yes, yes, I know who your head is, was at least a plain murderer. Something better than they have now made of him. Who are you to be exempt?"
Mark gasped. The discovery of how much Dimble knew had suddenly inverted his whole picture of the situation. No logic was left in him.
"Nevertheless," continued Dimble, "knowing all this, knowing that you may be only the bait in the trap, I will take a risk. I will risk things compared with which both our lives are a triviality. If you seriously wish to leave the NICE, I will help you."
One moment it was like the gates of paradise opening. Then, at once, caution and the incurable wish to temporize rushed back. The chink had closed again.
I'd need to think that over," he mumbled. "There is no time," said Dimble, "and there really is nothing to think about. I am offering you a way back into the human family, but you must come at once."
"Oh, it's a question affecting my whole future career."
"Your career," said Dimble. "It's a question of damnation or a last chance. But you must come at once."
"I don't think I understand," said Mark. "You keep on suggesting some kind of danger. What is it? And what powers have you to protect me, or Jane, if I do bolt?"
"You must risk that," said Dimble. "I can offer you no security. Don't you understand? There is no security for anyone now. The battle has started. I'm offering you a place on the right side. I don't know which will win."
"Well, as a matter of fact," said Mark, "I had been thinking of leaving, but I must think it over. You put things in rather an odd way."
"There is no time," said Dimble.
"Supposing I look you up again tomorrow?"
"Do you know that you'll be able?"
"Or in an hour. Come, that's only sensible. Will you be here in an hour's time?"
"What can an hour do for you? You are only waiting in the hope that your mind will be less clear."
"But will you be here?"
"If you insist. But no good can come of it."
"I want to think. I want to think," said Mark, and left the room without waiting for a reply. Mark had said he wanted to think. In reality, he wanted alcohol and tobacco. He had thoughts in plenty, more than he desired. One thought prompted him to cling to Dimble as a lost child clings to a grown-up. Another whispered to him, "Madness. Don't break with the NICE. They'll be after you. How can Dimble save you? You'll be killed." A third implored him not, even now, to write off as a total loss his hard-won position in the inner ring at Belbury. There must be some middle course. A fourth recoiled from the idea of ever seeing Dimble again. The memory of every tone Dimble had used caused horrible discomfort. And he wanted Jane, and he wanted to punish Jane for being a friend of Dimble's. And he wanted never to see Wither again, and he wanted to creep back and patch things up with Wither somehow.
He wanted to be perfectly safe, and yet also very nonchalant and daring, to be admired for manly honesty among the Dimbles, and yet also for realism and knowingness at Belbury, to have two more large whiskies, and also to think everything out very clearly and collectedly. And it was beginning to rain, and his head had begun to ache again. Oh, damn the whole thing. Damn, damn. Why had he such a rotten heredity? Why had his education been so ineffective? Why was the system of society so irrational? Why was his luck so bad? He began walking rapidly. It was raining quite hard as he reached the college lodge. Some sort of van seemed to be standing in the street outside, and there were three or four uniformed men in capes. He remembered afterwards how the wet oilskin shone in the lamplight. A torch was flashed in his face. "Excuse me, sir," said one of the men. "I must ask for your name."
"Studdock," said Mark.
"Mark Gainsby Studdock," said the man. "It is my duty to arrest you for the murder of William Hengist."
4. Dr. Dimble drove out to St. Anne's dissatisfied with himself, haunted with the suspicion that if he had been wiser or more perfectly in charity with this very miserable young man, he might have done something for him. "Did I give way to my temper? Was I self-righteous? Did I tell him as much as I dared?" he thought. Then came the deeper self-distrust that was habitual with him. "Did you fail to make things clear because you really wanted not to? Just wanted to hurt and humiliate? To enjoy your own self-righteousness? Is there a whole Belbury inside you, too?" The sadness that came over him had novelty in it. "And thus," he quoted from Brother Lawrence, "thus I shall always do, whenever you leave me to myself." Once clear of the town, he drove slowly, almost sauntering on wheels. The sky was red to westward, and the first stars were out. Far down below him, in a valley, he saw the lights already lit in Cure Hardy. "Thank heaven it, at any rate, is far enough from Edgestow to be safe," he thought. The sudden whiteness of a white owl flying low fluttered across the woody twilight on his left. It gave him a delicious feeling of approaching night. He was pleasantly tired. He looked forward to an agreeable evening and an early bed.
"Here he is. Here's Dr. Dimble," shouted Ivy Maggs as he drove up to the front door of the manor.
"Don't put the car away, Dimble," said Denniston.
"Oh, Cecil," said his wife, and he saw fear in her face. The whole household seemed to have been waiting for him. A few moments later, blinking in the lighted kitchen, he saw that this was not to be a normal evening. The director himself was there, seated by the fire, with the jackdaw on his shoulder and Mr. Bultitude at his feet. There were signs that everyone else had had an early supper, and Dimble found himself almost at once seated at the end of the table and being rather excitedly urged to eat and drink by his wife and Mrs. Maggs.
"Don't stop to ask questions, dear," said Mrs. Dimble. "Go on eating while they tell you. Make a good meal."
"You have to go out again," said Ivy Maggs.
"Yes," said the director. "We're going into action at last.
I'm sorry to send you out the moment you come in, but the battle has started."
"I have already repeatedly urged," said McPhee, "the absurdity of sending out an older man like yourself, a stunner day's work for by, when here am I, a great strapping fella sitting doing nothing."
"It's no good, McPhee," said the director. "You can't go. For one thing, you don't know the language, and for another, it's time for frankness. You have never put yourself under the protection of Maleldil."
"I'm perfectly ready," said McPhee, "in and for this emergency, to allow the existence of these Eldils of yours, and of a being called Maleldil, whom they regard as their king, and I—"
"You can't go," said the director. "I will not send you. It would be like sending a 3-year-old child to fight a tank. Put the other map on the table where Dimble can see it while he goes on with his meal. And now, silence. This is the situation, Dimble. What was under Bragdon was a living Merlin. Yes, asleep, if you like to call it sleep. And nothing has yet happened to show that the enemy have found him. Got that? No, don't talk. Go on eating. Last night, Jane Studdock had the most important dream she's had yet. You remember that in an earlier dream she saw, or so I thought, the very place where he lay under Bragdon. But, and this is the important thing, it's not reached by a shaft and a stair. She dreamed of going through a long tunnel with a very gradual ascent. Ah, you begin to see the point. You're right. Jane thinks she can recognize the entrance to that tunnel, under a heap of stones at the end of a copse with, what was it, Jane? A white gate, sir. an ordinary five-barred gate with a crosspiece, but the crosspiece was broken off about a foot from the top. I'd know it again.
You see, Dimble, there's a very good chance that this tunnel comes up outside the area held by the NICE.
You mean, said Dimble, that we can now get under Bragdon without going into Bragdon?
Exactly, but that's not all.
Dimble, steadily munching, looked at him.
Apparently, said the director, we are almost too late. He was waked already.
Dimble stopped eating.
Jane found the place empty, said Ransom.
You mean the enemy have already found him?
No, not quite as bad as that. The place had not been broken into. He seems to have waked of his own accord.
My God, said Dimble.
Try to eat, darling, said his wife.
But what does it mean? He asked, covering her hand with his.
I think it means that the whole thing has been planned and timed long, long ago, said the director, that he went out of time into the parachronic state for the very purpose of returning at this moment.
A sort of human time bomb, observed McPhee, which is why...
You can't go, McPhee, said the director.
Is he out? Asked Dimble.
He probably is by now, said the director. Tell him what it was like, Jane.
It was the same place, said Jane. A dark place, all stone, like a cellar. I recognized it at once. And the slab of stone was there, but no one lying on it. And this time it wasn't quite cold. Then I dreamed about this tunnel, gradually sloping up from the souterrain. And there was a man in the tunnel. Of course I couldn't see him, it was pitch dark. But a great big man, breathing heavily. At first I thought it was an animal. It got colder as we went up the tunnel. There was air, a little air, from outside. It seemed to end in a pile of loose stones. He was pulling them about just before the dream changed. Then I was outside, in the rain. That was when I saw the white gate.
It looks, you see, said Ransom, as if they had not yet, or not then, established contact with him. That is our only chance now, to meet this creature before they do.
You will all have observed that Bragdon is very nearly waterlogged, put in McPhee. Where exactly you'll find a dry cavity in which a body could be preserved all these centuries is a question worth asking. That is, if any of you are still concerned with evidence.
Well, that's the point, said the director. The chamber must be under the high ground, the gravelly ridge on the south of the wood where it slopes up to the Eaton Road, near where Story used to live. That's where you'll have to look first for Jane's white gate. I suspect it opens on the Eaton Road, or else that other road. Look at the map, the yellow one that runs up into the Y of Cure Hardy.
We can be there in half an hour, said Dimble, his hand still on his wife's hands. To everyone in that room, the sickening excitement of the last minutes before battle had come nearer.
I suppose it must be tonight, said Mrs. Dimble, rather shamefacedly.
I am afraid it must, Margaret, said the director. Every minute counts. We have practically lost the war if the enemy once make contact with him. Their whole plan probably turns on it.
Of course. I see. I'm sorry, said Mrs. Dimble.
And what is our procedure, sir?
Said Dimble, pushing his plate away from him and beginning to fill his pipe.
The first question is whether he's out, said the director. It doesn't seem likely that the entrance to the tunnel has been hidden all these centuries by nothing but a heap of loose stones. And if it has, they wouldn't be very loose by now. He may take hours getting out.
"You'll need at least two strong men with pecks," began McPhee.
"It's no good, McPhee," said the director. "I'm not letting you go. If the mouth of the tunnel is still sealed, you must wait there. But he may have powers we don't know. If he's out, you must look for tracks. Thank God it's a muddy night. You must just hunt him."
"If Jane is going, sir," said Camilla, "couldn't I go too? I've had more experience of this sort of thing than—"
"Jane has to go because she is the guide," said Ransom. I am afraid you must stay at home. We in this house are all that is left of Logas. You carry its future in your body. As I was saying, Dimble, you must hunt. I do not think he can get far. The country will, of course, be quite unrecognizable to him, even by daylight.
And if we do find him, sir?
That is why it must be you, Dimble. Only you know the great tongue. If there was Eldilic power behind the tradition he represented, he may understand it. Even if he does not understand it, he will, I think, recognize it. That will teach him he is dealing with masters. There is a chance that he will think you are the Belbury people, his friends. In that case, you will bring him here at once.
"And if not?" The director spoke sternly. "Then you must show your hand. That is the moment when the danger comes. We do not know what the powers of the old Atlantean circle were. Some kind of hypnotism probably covered most of it. Don't be afraid, but don't let him try any tricks. Keep your hand on your revolver. You too, Deniston."
"I'm a good hand with a revolver myself," said McPhee. "And why, in the name of all common sense?"
"You can't go, McPhee," said the director. "He'd put you to sleep in 10 seconds. The others are heavily protected, as you are not. You understand, Dimble? Your revolver in your hand, a prayer on your lips, your mind fixed on Maleldil. Then, if he stands, conjure him."
"What shall I say in the great tongue?"
"Say that you come in the name of God and all angels and in the power of the planets from one who sits today in the seat of the Pendragon, and command him to come with you. Say it now." And Dimble, who had been sitting with his face drawn and rather white, between the white faces of the two women and his eyes on the table, raised his head, and great syllables of words that sounded like castles came out of his mouth. Jane felt her heart leap and quiver at them. Everything else in the room seemed to have been intensely quiet. Even the bird and the bear and the cat were still, staring at the speaker. The voice did not sound like Dimble's own. It was as if the words spoke themselves through him from some strong place at a distance, or as if they were not words at all, but present operations of God, the planets, and the Pendragon. For this was the language spoken before the fall and beyond the moon, and the meanings were not given to the syllables by chance or skill or long tradition, but truly inherent in them, as the shape of the great sun is inherent in the little water drop. This was language herself, as she first sprang at Maleldil's bidding out of the molten quicksilver of the star called Mercury on Earth, but Viritrilbia in deep heaven. "Thank you," said the director in English, and once again the warm domesticity of the kitchen flowed back upon them. "And if he comes with you, all is well. If he does not, why then, Dimble, you must rely on your Christianity. Do not try any tricks. Say your prayers and keep your will fixed in the will of Maleldil. I don't know what he will do, but stand firm. You can't lose your soul, whatever happens, at least not by any action of his."
"Yes," said Dimble, "I understand."
There was a longish pause. Then the director spoke again. "Don't be cast down, Margaret," he said. "If they kill Cecil, we shall none of us be let live many hours after him. It will be a shorter separation than you could have hoped for in the course of nature. And now, gentlemen," he said, "you would like a little time to say your prayers and to say goodbye to your wives. It is 8 now, as near as makes no matter. Suppose you all reassemble here at 8:10, ready to start." "Very good," answered several voices. Jane found herself left alone in the kitchen with Mrs. Maggs and the animals and McPhee and the director. "You are all right, child?" said Ransom.
"I think so, sir," said Jane.
Her actual state of mind was one she could not analyze. Her expectation was strung up to the height. Something that would have been terror but for the joy, and joy but for the terror, possessed her. An all-absorbing tension of excitement and obedience. Everything else in her life seemed small and commonplace compared with this moment. "Do you place yourself in the obedience?" said the director. "In obedience to Maleldil?"
"Sir," said Jane, "I know nothing of Maleldil, but I place myself in obedience to you."
"It is enough for the present," said the director. "This is the courtesy of deep heaven, that when you mean well, he always takes you to have meant better than you knew. It will not be enough for always. He is very jealous. He will have you for no one but himself in the end. But for tonight, it is enough."
"This is the craziest business I ever heard of," said McPhee.